test it first. Right. You want me to do it?
This is Shirley Abram and Marion Cabot for the National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, on July 7th, 1982. And we are interviewing Mr. Meyer Berger in his office. Mr. Berger, would you just, we would just like to be sure that we're going to be able to get the tone of your voice. So.
Well, I would just like to testify and affirm that I'm here, mm-hmm. if there's been any doubt about it.
All right. Thank you. We'd like to start first, Mr. Berger, by asking you about your immediate family, your father and mother, and any brothers or sisters, where they were born.
Yeah. Well, my father was born in Poland and came over here in 1899. To escape going into the army of Franz Joseph. Mm-hmm. But also, he was the eldest in a family of eight, and I suspect one of the reasons that were unstated for his coming was that I think he felt oppressed by the strong will of his father and lack of personal freedom. Very outspoken and determined man.
Did your mother come with him? Or did
no, he? My mother came from Bessarabia, which was then Russian, in 1906. And that, I think, was a fear of pogroms, which were taking place nearby at the time. My father's background was that his father was a caretaker of a large estate, a manager of an estate. And in those terms, I think they lived a pretty good life. My mother's father was a farmer. And that was their background in a very lush area of Bessarabia.
And
they met in Cleveland after my father had settled there. My mother's family came direct to Cleveland. My father wandered through many jobs. He came over here as a boy of 18. Got off the boat in which he'd had a terrible passage. He ran a high fever. They took him right from the boat to a hospital where he had a mastoid operation. That's an operation that's become obsolete because of penicillin and so forth. But it was a very serious operation. And here he landed and found himself in a hospital, not speaking the language and knowing no one. He really arrived penniless and had to start from scratch. Just peddled, carried seltzer in cases up to the top floors in New York, and gradually wandered out to the Middle West, got himself a horse and wagon, and went out peddling in the countryside with goods from the city and returned with produce. And over a period of about 10 years, he accumulated enough to start a little business. And as I was growing up, he was a small merchant. We never thought of ourselves as poor. In fact, somewhat affluent compared to the contemporary standards, the standards of our neighbors. He was the first on the block in the neighborhood to have a car that was a 1917. I remember in a Dodge. I was 5 at the time. And he was strictly, a very strict Orthodox, a very strong, strongly observant man, never worked on a Sabbath in his life. I had two brothers, one a year and a half older, one a year and a half younger, both still living. We were a very close family. I'm afraid I found the strict orthodoxy oppressive, and rebelled from it as early an age as I could, which is 16 when I left home to go to college. I had a happy boyhood, went to Cleveland Heights High School, which was a coming neighborhood in those days, and it was more like a private school, you might say. It was a newly built school. It was in active in athletics and dramatics and school romances and all that kind of thing. I got out of high school at the age of 16 and went to Ohio State. I was always rather good at school. Very good when I got to college for a couple of years until I got messing around with so many extracurricular activities.
What years were you at Ohio State?
I was at Ohio State from 1928 to 1933, and at the end of that time I'd had 2 years of law. But I went down to Ohio State as the offspring of a middle-class family to the fraternity house and, you know, and everything you expected in those days. But after about 2 years, I found myself working in the kitchen to get through in the fraternity house. And the year after that, the fraternity house no longer existed, so that by about 1931, I just had to... my father was pretty well... defunct financially at that time in the business, and I just had to find a way to scratch through to summer work and whatever I could do on the campus, like booking jazz bands into the fraternity house for dances, and I got as much as one of the musicians, so that was pretty good.
That was a big
okay. And, yeah.
And you were saying that you found the orthodoxy oppressive.
Yes. I took my fill-in with me the day I went to college and never put them on after that. And I think that was fairly representative of youth at that time. And I also got rid of my military uniform and after a year and refused to take military training.
Was that ROTC then?
ROTC. It was a land-grant college, and ROTC was a necessity. As a result, I never had the formality of getting a degree, although I had the credits. I lacked a year of military training. But early on, I had that feeling, and it's stayed with me since, and I'm militarist. And it gets me in trouble to this day, even when Israel is, especially when Israel is a party to it. So I find myself sometimes criticizing their policies.
Talk a little louder. Please.
I find myself sometimes criticizing their policies, but it's consistent with beliefs that I've held almost all my life. Not to say I'm not, yes, I'm not an outright pacifist. Uh-huh. I'm not a unilateral disarmist, but I'm very sensitive to use of force unless it's absolutely necessary.
Would you like to talk to us about what's going on in Israel today? Your feelings about?
Would you like me to skip over and or continue chronologically?
Well, whichever you would prefer. We can continue chronologically get to that.
We'll get to it.
Okay.
All right.
In your young home life, when you were at home, were there any cultural activities that your parents participated in at that time?
Not really. We had one of the early victrolas, and we had canters on records.
Interesting.
Yes. That was my dad's, my father's greatest pleasure. to hear Cantor Rosenblatt and some
on
of the
record.
Others. On record.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably about 1920. Mm-hmm. The only day I ever remember my father not going to work is the day they delivered the Victrola.
That was a big event.
The kind with the horn on it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And after you graduated college, did you return to Cleveland? Did you stay
no.
in Cleveland at that time?
No, this was, it was then 1933. Mm-hmm. The banks had closed. I had had 2 years of law. The leading member of the class that graduated that year was the only one to get a job. That was at $15 a week with a prestigious law firm in Toledo, Ohio. So I thought it was a pretty good time for me to try my hand at something. Since after 5 years of higher education, I'd progressed from middle class to poverty in my last year, all had a room in a rooming house, paid $2 a week. We had the use of the stove in the basement. We each put in $2 a week and for food. Ate three meals a day there in our little penthouse in the basement.
What city was this?
This was Columbus.
Columbus.
In
you
Columbus.
Stayed in Columbus,
yes.
Where the university was.
Yes. And that was my last year in school. When the banks closed, nobody had any cash.
Mm-hmm.
So we bought a side of pork and a burlap bag of baked beans and put it in the pot and had enough to eat for about a week.
For several days.
so we beat the game that way. But it was impossible to get a job. I thought I might be able to sell something. There were plenty of goods to sell, but not many buyers. And the only thing you could sell was on commission. And if you sold something and the company got paid, and if they didn't go broke, then you got your commission. But the trouble was in financing yourself in the interim. Well, by that time, I was 21, and I had been married in college.
Okay.
Married. And just decided we had to get away and drifted over to Pittsburgh and started to sell the first thing that came along, which was a drug item. So my early experience was in the drug business. And I called on every individual drugstore in this part of the country. It was in the days before the chain stores. It was 1933, and it was pretty bleak. I think I took in $1,200 gross commissions. I had to pay my own expenses, including owning a car. And that went on for few years, just trying to fight to stay afloat. You would, miss a meal here and there, and sleep in the car if you didn't have the price of a hotel room on the road, only to come back and find the gas had been shut off in your apartment with a wife and infant child there. And that was Pittsburgh in 33, 34, 35.
Did you meet your wife in college? Was she?
No, we were together in high school.
Oh, you were together in high school.
Yeah.
She was from Cleveland.
Yes, she was from Cleveland. Her grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi in Zanesville, Ohio, in 1880. Mm-hmm. He'd been brought over from a Galician congregation because that was the third shul that they had in Zanesville in those days. Wasn't enough. They had a German and a Hungarian. They had to have a Galicianer.
Mm-hmm.
And when the coalfields played out around Zanesville, why, most of the Jews went to Cleveland. That's why you have the biggest Hungarian congregation there, the B'nai Ashurin. And my grandfather went up there my wife's grandfather went up to start the first Orthodox congregation in Cleveland around 1880, shortly after 1880. And my father was in early 1900s a member of his congregation. So when I brought my prospective wife home, Merle Ganger, well, you know, she could do no wrong because she was the rabbi's granddaughter. So we went together from high school days.
Did you two agree on orthodoxy? She came from a
well,
more Orthodox
but,
background
but,
than
but,
you did.
But her husband, her father, came here as a boy, and he wasn't quite as strict. Mm-hmm. But and she was confirmed from the B'nai Yeshurun, a conservative temple there. So we quite agreed on, on what our religious beliefs were and the form they should take. Although for the first few years here, we belonged to no congregation, couldn't afford to, and just concentrated on staying afloat.
I can understand that.
But after our first youngster came, well, we joined the Rosh Hashanah some little time after that.
When was your first child born?
In 1935.
Is that a son?
Yes. He's now president of the business, and this past weekend his son was bar mitzvah.
Oh, nice.
Mark Berger. That was our first. So it's a very momentous time for us with a family reunion. Family coming from all around the country.
When during your school days, Mr. Berger, did you find that you were influenced by any teachers in particular?
Oh yes, I remember a few. Very liberal, and in those days, there was a strong reaction against Hooverism, and don't forget, I went down there when Calvin Coolidge was president. And it was the first Hoover election in 1928. By 1932, we had a mock convention, and to the consternation of the administrators of the university, we nominated Norman Thomas as the Democratic candidate for
was this
for
at
president.
Ohio State?
Yes, at Ohio State in 1932. We were quite embarrassed by that. But FDR was seen then as just more of the same as part of the old school. So of course, we were happily surprised by the way he took charge in 1933 when the banks closed. He made that speech about you have nothing to fear but fear itself, and he took hold with firm reins and brought a lot of imaginative legislation into the Congress, so that we quickly changed our estimation of him. And he played a very important part in my life, both in terms of meeting a need that I saw as a young man to make some important changes, and brought hope. He would get on the radio with the fireside chats, and no matter how bad things were, you felt there was somebody in charge there, and with an ideology that was very sensitive to the common man, to the unemployed, to the bottom layer, where I was at the time. And one had hope. And as years went on, a lot of us rose with the tide as things got better. But a good many who were unprepared, who were uneducated, they remained there, and they're still there. So it's given me a great humility about what your heritage is. And if you have education and abilities and training, you can take advantage of times as they got better. But those who didn't are still there, and their grandchildren are still there. And I'm very unhappy about the present insensitivity to the poor and to those who weren't able to make it.
We're going to go into that a little later.
But I mean, that's the background for my continued belief and my loyalty to the Democratic Party. And as time went on, our economic position became better. I was about 12 years a manufacturer's agent on the road. And about 1945, I had enough money. I had saved about $10,000 and started my own business.
what type of an item were you...
By that time, I was selling anything that chain stores would buy. And in those days, the stores would buy many things for leaders. I started out in drugs and surgical dressings and got into general merchandise, which I sold to chains. But there was stepladders or light bulbs or washcloths, or you remember that time when they would use them for lost leaders to bring people in the store. There was such a thing as fair trade laws then, where you weren't allowed to break the price of an advertised drug item. That's since been found unconstitutional. But in those days, they had to devise ways of creating traffic to bring people in.
Promotional items.
Yeah, and I recognized that need, and I began to get items from manufacturers and wholesalers and sell them to the chains.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, I was making a pretty good living and able to save some money. And I just decided that if I was going to sell these people, I would rather own the goods and make a wholesaler's markup rather than a salesman's brokerage. And I was fortunate enough, in 45, after the war, there was a great demand for goods, and my starting business coincided with that.
And in your youth, was your health good? Were you,
yes.
What type of medical care did you encounter?
Almost none.
Mm-hmm.
I played football in high school, and intramural basketball in college, and you know, I was a sports nut, like most of the kids were, and I had an abiding interest in the theater, ever since grade school, and it was in a good many college shows, and after I got on my feet here, I began to participate first at the Y and then at the Pittsburgh Playhouse for 7 years. I kind of lost interest in all that when I started my own business, and nothing could divert me from it.
But during your adolescent years?
There. Harold Cohn, the writer for the Post-Gazette,
mm-hmm.
once asked me why he didn't see me at the Playhouse anymore. And I replied that I had retired by popular demand, and he printed it.
Did he really?
Yeah. So I always got a lot of kidding about that.
Where did you make your home when you moved
to Pittsburgh? Well, found the area around the University of Pittsburgh was attractive to me because I had just come off of a campus a couple of months before.
Mm-hmm.
And after being here about 3 months, I brought my wife, and we had a little furnished two-room apartment on Dithridge Street with a bathroom down the hall. And we were there until the first of the year, and we found a little apartment in Dormont. And that was like living in another city. But we didn't know anyone then. It didn't matter a lot. And we lived there about 2 or 3 years until my wife, I think the first dollar I ever made, she insisted that we move into Squirrel Hill. We found a place on Beachman Boulevard. By 1936, I was making enough to pay my bills every week, so we moved to Squirrel Hill.
You had the one son?
No, and then I had a daughter about in 1939.
What was her name?
Her name was Susan. My son's name is Michael, and they both have made careers for themselves. As I say, my son is president of the company here. He went to Harvard and got interested in art and took an MA here at Pitt at night after he finished his Army service, an MA in fine arts, and he started the Michael Berger Gallery, which has become quite well known as, you might say, the best known contemporary art gallery, bringing contemporary artists to Pittsburgh. And it's enhanced our life, as you can see, and we have quite an art collection at home. And to take great interest in it. When we travel almost anywhere, we almost know what's in the museums by this time. But it's our son's education has enriched our lives. When he was taking his MA, I took those night classes with him at Pitt. And it was great to go back to school after 30 years. And I enjoyed it thoroughly. But, got the credits and it was a very nice time.
That courses in art education?
Well, it was courses in the development of contemporary art starting in about 1876, which they use as a date, right up to that year, 58, which was 1958, which was a year of the Carnegie International. We bought our first art that year, but it was the heyday of abstract art.
Did your family travel together as your children were growing up? Did you take family vacations?
Oh yes, very much so. As soon as we were able to, mm-hmm. after I got in business for myself, we were able to afford to do so. We would go to Washington, New York, Florida often, mm-hmm. back home to Cleveland often. Kids would go to camp in the summer. The usual thing. They grew up in that Squirrel Hill, society, high school fraternities and sorority, all over organized society.
You think it's changed much, Squirrel Hill?
I really am unable to say. It's been so long. I think it has some. Wipen School is closed, for one thing. And there's so much private school today. When Michael went to Shadyside and Susan went to Ellis, then they were among the few Jewish children there. You're talking about the middle 50s now. Susie was valedictorian of her class. Always a bright student. She went on to Wellesley and she got two MAs, one in education and one in sociology, one in English at the University of Pittsburgh, and went on to get her PhD at the University of Pittsburgh.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and she's now a professional counselor in West Hartford, and she's writing a book on matching children with schools. And,
she married?
Oh yes, she has a 9-year-old granddaughter and a 7-year-old grandson. And this just may be of interest to you. After being brought up in such a reformed background, she now sends one of her children to Solomon Schechter Day School, which is a conservative day school. Yeah, but she's become more observant than the way she was raised.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
Reversal of happening.
Yes, I think it's happening. Awesome. Yeah, in a good many cases. And
that would be Michael's child.
No, that's Susan's.
Susan.
No,
that was Farmer Susan.
Yeah. No, Susan's children in West Hartford.
Yeah,
going to the day school.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, yeah. But Michael's grandson, Michael's daughter, graduated. That is his stepdaughter, although she's been adopted. Mm-hmm. Michael's wife was not born Jewish, but she converted before their marriage, and her daughter was graduated from Rosh Hashanah, mm-hmm. and the grandson was just confirmed from Rosh Hashanah. Mm-hmm. With great honor and distinction, I might say.
That's right.
I'm telling you things which might be interesting to us as a Jewish community.
Very, yes.
My grandson's parents were born Jewish in Vienna, generations. They joined the Church of England in Vienna and escaped to London in 1936, just before Hitler came into Vienna. My son-in-law was brought up in the Church of England, although he had many Jewish cousins in Israel and in places around the world. He came here